Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and we got a huge lead for you this week. We're going to tackle several topics, including how you may be saving money on future SCE&G power bills, major congressional news involving our state's most fashion-forward Congressman Trey Gowdy, fierce, and a look at potential political fallout from the Amtrak crash in Casey. Interested? I hope so. It is, after all, why we named this podcast the South Carolina Lead, spelled L-E-D-E, which harkens back to the old-school spelling for the introductory section of a news story, intended to entice the reader to read the full article. Well, we hope you listen to all four sections of our podcast that we've exclusively curated for you from certified organic news sources. All of our guests are free range, and this is farm-to-table news, people. This podcast is best enjoyed in the mornings as you rush out of the house just to get stuck in Charlotte Rock Hill traffic or wonder if this is actually a Tide commercial. It's not. It is. And now, quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there is a majority present. But here on the South Carolina Lead, we know majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. First up, Republican South Carolina Lieutenant Governor Kevin Bryant, who is running for governor, has called for a change in voter registration rules that would require primary voters to vote only for the party they are registered with. Bryant believes that closed primaries will protect the integrity of the state's elections altogether. He told the Greenville News that some 60,000 voters who cast ballots in South Carolina's 2016 Democratic presidential primary took part months later in the Republican primary for state elections. Next up, South Carolina made national headlines in December when education advocates noticed that proposed social studies standards for the state's public schools made no mention of the Holocaust, Nazism, or Adolf Hitler. Now, that's not all that was missing, according to the Post and Courier. The current draft of education standards, which go into effect in 2020, makes no mention of such key civil rights era figures as Rosa Parks, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., nor does it include any major events from South Carolina history. Now, the new standards will be accompanied by a, quote, support document, which is hundreds of pages long and includes specific names, events, and people that will be covered in class, according to the South Carolina Department of Education. Now, the above terms are included in the current draft of the support document, according to officials. Now for some utility news. If South Carolina lawmakers decide to sell Santee Cooper, at least three of the other state's electric cooperatives are interested in buying a piece. That's according to the Post and Courier. Now, Berkeley Electric Cooperative, Santee Electric, and Ori Electric said they would be interested in buying a part of Santee Cooper's territory. The interest of the three co-ops adds a new dimension to Governor Henry McMaster's effort to sell Santee Cooper, which is a government-owned utility. The state's 20 cooperatives buy most of the power Santee Cooper generates, so they play a key role in the sale process. And following up on what we discussed on the lead last week, U.S. Interior Department confirmed to the Associated Press that Secretary Ryan Zinke met Friday with South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster at the governor's mansion in Columbia. Now, McMaster is a staunch ally of President Donald Trump, but he's seeking an exemption from the administration's proposal to expand offshore drilling for oil and natural gas. McMaster, like dozens of other elected officials in the state, say offshore drilling poses too much of a threat to the state's robust $20 billion tourism industry, which is based heavily on the state's, quote, Gold Coast, as he called it in his State of the State address. Now, from gold to plutonium to even copper, we have several more elements to cover in the lead this week, which I now notice has been buried once again. Well, things have remained busy here in Columbia, so we decided to take a shotgun approach to our lead this week and cover several current stories with the reporters closest to the action. We're talking with two of the Post and Courier's Statehouse reporters, Andy Brown and Jamie Lovegrove, on their Sunday story about the breakdown of trust between lawmakers and SCANA amid the ongoing debacle over the VC Summer nuclear project. Jamie, Andy, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
This story comes on the heels of the South Carolina House of Representatives passing a bill last week that would temporarily halt payments to SCANA, which could save you around $27 a month on your SCE&G power bill. Now, that bill is now over in the Senate, and we'll get more details on it and its future in a minute. Now, we had some major breaking news this Sunday that y'all also covered extensively, involving the collision of an Amtrak train with a parked CSX train, which left 2 people dead and 100 injured. This is Amtrak's 3rd incident in less than 7 weeks. While we're told human error appears to be at fault, it is likely that it could have been avoided had congressionally mandated technology already been in place. And speaking of Congress, South Carolina 4th Congressional District Representative Trey Gowdy, who chairs the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, announced last week that he would not seek re-election for a 5th term. But as people pile into the 4th Congressional District race for Gowdy's seat that covers Spartanburg and Greenville counties, news about the 5th Congressional District flew onto our radar screen last week as well, when it was announced that the Democratic challenger Archie Parnell outraised incumbent Congressman Ralph Norman. So let's start with Scana in the Statehouse. Let's recap your Sunday story. You guys both did a joint byline story about kind of the breakdown of trust and the egos that are at play, the moving parts, and just where things kind of stand right now and what led to this breakdown of trust. Where do things stand between Scana and House lawmakers? Andy, if you want to lead off on this and just tell me what the current scene is and what your story kind of uncovered.
I think our story was essentially meant to show the scenes over the past 6 months, if people haven't been paying attention, of how a once great relationship between Scana and lawmakers kind of dissolved. And so we set the scene in several different instances, one being a weekend in October, whenever lawmakers reportedly got word that the Scana board was going to remove their former CEO, Kevin Marsh. They kind of cheered that. Most lawmakers expected it after the cancellation of the nuclear units in Fairfield County. But then it quickly turned, and Scana sent out a press release after a story by the state that said that's not true at all. Kevin Marsh isn't leaving. It really made the situation worse, lawmakers told us this past week. And it was kind of the final straw for many of them in their discussions and in their relationship with Scana. And so we've seen that type of event kind of carry on up until this last week, where the House voted 119-1 in favor of a bill that would stop the payments for the nuclear reactors that customers currently give to Scana every month.
And Jimmy, what did you kind of add to that, a little bit about what you are feeling, what you're seeing with some of these lawmakers dealing with this current situation with Scana? I mean, is it kind of out the window now at this point, where it's just, hey, we're not really worried about your feelings or this thought that you guys might go bankrupt when you've been kind of crying Chicken Little over and over that you're going to go bankrupt with whatever happens in the Statehouse? I mean, what's the move?
Absolutely. I mean, that's key. Something I think we heard directly from someone was it's kind of a, you know, boy who cried wolf situation. They kept raising alarms throughout the fall, and then things wouldn't come true. You know, they kept saying, if you release this, if you release that, it's going to imperil our company. It's going to ruin attorney-client privilege. It's going to do this. It's going to do that. And eventually, I mean, lawmakers just expected that Scana was going to come out of the aftermath of this and apologize and have show some kind of remorse, show some kind of acceptance of responsibility. And instead, you know, in the words of Representative Russell Ott, you know, it was arrogance. It was, you know, we're the executive team of Scana. How dare you question us? You know, you just have to accept what we're doing here. That was really what ruined this longstanding relationship. It was egos. It was lawmakers want to be shown respect, especially after they feel like they had been misled for years about the true state of this project. And instead, Scana showed them quite the opposite. And now it seems like that relationship really is going to take a very, very long time to recover.
But we see some outside players. I remember last week, you know, outside players kind of going to bat for Scana in a sense, and Dominion also at the same time. Dominion Energy, which is trying to merge with Scana, is still a work in progress. But, you know, speaking of partners trying to go to bat for these guys, the Chamber of Commerce is not very big on what was happening last week with the repeal of the Baseload Review Act. They came out against it. They're saying it's bad for business growth. Andy, can you talk a little bit about why the chamber's kind of really anti-repealing this, even though customers stand to benefit in the end from repealing this bill that has put them on the hook for something that's not going to ever produce any electricity?
I think what most people jump to immediately is that Dominion probably donated some money to the chamber. You know, that's what many lawmakers, including the House Speaker, jumped to on the House floor and discuss. That being said, investment analysts are concerned with how other businesses will look on South Carolina with a repeal of the Baseload Review Act. Essentially what they're saying is, how do you trust doing business in a state where a law is on the books and a company relies on that law for 10 years only to turn around and have that law pulled back from them and cast that company into financial ruin? Not all of that I think is fair, because I think what's going to play out here is a very thorough investigation of what Scana knew and when, whether or not they withheld information from the state and its state, the state's utility regulators. So it's a little more nuanced than that. But markets read cues, right? And so if a company, a large company, is manufacturer, say, is looking to locate in South Carolina, and as part of that relocation plan, they're relying on a certain law in South Carolina, it may come into their mind now that they have to worry that in 10 years or 15 years, the state will say, that wasn't good for business, and you owe us a bunch of money back.
But like we keep saying, a little bit different circumstances, a little bit with Scana. I mean, this bill was passed in 2007 into law so that customers would be paying for the construction of the VC Summer, the two reactors out there that are just now holes in the ground. And since there was a little bit more, you could say, misleading, possibly deceit, because no one ever really got the full picture of this, kind of changed the course of how that was supposed to play out. So you could, you know, there's going to be arguments going forward about, you know, like you said, who knew what when and how that plays out in the business community. But Jamie, sticking with the chamber and sticking with some outside forces, this bill is now in the Senate. Senate's a different animal than the House. If you guys don't know the difference, there's 124 representatives in the House. There's 46 over in the Senate, a little bit tighter control over in the Senate, a little bit more power from each of those lawmakers over there. They're the deliberative body. They take their time. That's what they're known for. The House was really keyed up and really moved this bill and several other bills over to the Senate, where they're kind of still right now just kind of sitting. There's been some committee action about this. But what's the mood over in the Senate? You know, you talked to Senate Majority Leader Shane Massey. He's a Republican from Edgefield. He seems a little bit more into it. But overall, what's the mood? I mean, we're talking about the chamber also. I mean, a lot of those guys are big pro-business guys, economic development guys, and you have the chamber saying, whoa, 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 this might hurt you. A lot of dynamics. Can you break those down for us?
Yeah. So we talked to both Senate Majority Leader Shane Massey and Senate Minority Leader Nikki Setzler last week, both of whom co-chaired the Senate's VC Summer Nuclear Committee. We asked them, what impact does the chamber have on this? And they both shrugged. The two of them were like absolutely nothing. In fact, Massey was similarly to Speaker Jay Lucas. You know, he kind of cast it as, oh, they just got some money from Dominion. They basically got bought off. You know, we really have no proof necessarily of that. But we do know that Dominion was sponsoring a chamber event 2 days before the announcement came out. You know, the folks who have been very closely involved in this, like Senator Massey and like Senator Setzler, they do tend to take on a similar tone to the rambunctious folks in the House, really kind of coming with a populist message here. The ones who have not been as involved are what we're going to have to find out about. I think there's a lot of senators we really don't know at this point. You know, where they stand on this. You know, the Senate is a body where just a small handful of senators can really gum up the process. You know, we talked to Senator Luke Rankin, who has actually been pretty involved in this, and he described the House as populist. You know, he said that they're just, you know, coming for the money and they don't really care what the consequences are. So he did not sound super into the resolutions that the House had worked out. But this was an unusual process in the State House in that the House and the Senate were working arm in arm throughout a lot of this process. Normally, you know, there is more division between the House and the Senate than there are between the Democrats and the Republicans. But on this process, they worked very closely together. Speaker Lucas said it was very important to make sure the Senate was looped in so that they had a better chance of getting this through in the Senate. So we'll see if that work is going to pan out.
And then just kind of wrapping up on this section, because I know we have other topics to talk about, but Andy, kind of along those lines, we've been talking about this. Lawmakers have been meeting on this since last August, probably before then, even behind closed doors in some senses. Is it easy to say that this should be gummed up when, I mean, does this need to be gummed up? Can it be rushed through a little bit more, or a little bit expedited? I mean, when you look at how the Baseload Review Act, which is the law that got us into this situation, went through, and you want to talk about ramifications that maybe weren't entirely thought through, you know, how does that maybe juxtapose? And then also you have the governor who said, send me this bill. I will sign it. I want to get rid of this. I want to get these ratepayers off the hook. Are we seeing that pressure build for the Senate to actually move through and not drag this out to possibly August, which they could also do?
I mean, Senator Massey, who is the Senate Majority Leader, Republican from Edgefield, seems very interested in passing it. He doesn't control the committee. Luke Rankin controls the committee, a Republican from Conway. That being said, there's a lot of pressure being put on the Senate now to pass what the House did. You know, they don't have to run for re-election this year, but you have senators like Mike Fanning of
Fairfield
County, who is essentially taking the message to his colleagues of every month we wait, Scana customers pay another $37 million to fund two power plants that will never produce a single kilowatt of electricity. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty strong message. And he puts it in terms, whenever you speak to him, as a older woman maybe who is on a fixed income and can't afford that extra $27 a month. Mm-hmm. And so you have senators like that that are really trying to hammer home the message. And honestly, I think the Senate wants to move on to other subjects. It'll be interesting to see if that plays into it, where lawmakers who are opposed to this bill ultimately maybe give up and kind of move on and choose their battles.
Mm-hmm. And then, Andy, kind of going along to the other breaking news, major breaking news from this weekend, the Amtrak crash that happened in Casey around 2:40 in the morning on Sunday morning. And Casey is just south of Columbia here, where about 100-some people were injured, transported to hospitals for a variety of injuries, and two people actually died. Tragic accident. Tell us just a brief overview of what happened and what officials are saying right now could have prevented this from happening.
So what happened yesterday morning around 2 in the morning, a train that was traveling southbound from New York to Florida came into a section of track owned by CSX. It was a passenger rail car, over 100 people on board, including the crew, and they took a section of track where there was a parked freight train already. It barreled headlong into that, derailed many of the passenger cars, toppling some of them and jackknifing others. The conductor and the other crew member in the front engine were killed. Over 100 passengers, I believe, were sent to hospitals, some with scrapes and bruises, others with broken bones. Palmetto Health said that one was in critical condition still. And it was pretty tragic. In any case, the result was largely caused by a switch, which is, in the technical sense, a lever that allows one train to skip from one track to the other. It was left open so that the passenger train went down the wrong track and collided with that freight car. And here we are.
And so we heard from the National Transportation Safety Board Chairman Robert Sumwalt yesterday. They're down here investigating. Sumwalt is actually a Columbia native, happened to be in Columbia this weekend, was briefing the press on this issue. Jamie, you were there covering it. We were packed into the SCMD press room like I've never seen it before. Yeah. And was giving some interesting details, one of which we heard was that this is pretty much a result of human error. However, it could have been prevented if technology that has been mandated by Congress was actually put into place. And that technology is called positive train control. I'm sure you've probably heard about it because a lot of incidents have occurred throughout over the years because of this technology not being in place. But because if it was in place, it would have been prevented. Can you talk about that technology, Jamie, and just where it stands right now with some congressional background?
So basically what positive train control does is it would auto-brake the train if it is going through a red signal. So if the conductor and the engineers miss a signal for some reason, the positive train control would stop the train in that kind of situation. And in this particular incident, it certainly sounds like from Mr. Sumwalt that it would have prevented this accident, and it could have prevented several others over the last few years. The state of this is that, you know, the companies, CSX, for example, is still basically installing it. they were supposed to be done by 2015, and they just haven't been able to wrap it up yet. Of course, you know, there's always questions about more funding. So it's certainly going to be something that is going to come under the microscope from this. And it's another example for someone who's been calling for them to finish this for a long time mm-hmm. can now say, look, this is another incident where we could have prevented deaths if we had been more if we had taken a more aggressive approach to getting this done.
Yeah, because that technology also, it knows when there's a green signal. It also knows when a switch is incorrectly switched, because that switch right there here in Casey, it sent it to a sidetrack, that train barreling down a sidetrack, which it was just not ever supposed to be on, and it just caused a horrific accident, which I think probably could have been a lot worse. I mean, it was horrible as it was, but mm-hmm. two deaths, a couple critical injuries, but a lot of people were able to walk away from that incident, including the other week. We also had another train accident, separate incident because it hit a dump truck that was on tracks. Mm-hmm. But three of our congressmen were in that train accident. Mm-hmm. Do we know where they're all on board with positive train control? Do we know details about their stances on that? I mean,
I don't know if we know much of the details, their stances. It may well affect the way that they feel about it. I mean, Congressman Joe Wilson in particular, was on that train with the congressman, and then this train incident was in his district. So he's now had two train crashes in just the last couple weeks that have very personally affected him. Look, I don't know that Congress has really been the central sticking point. I mean, partly it's that the companies have to get this done. But, you know, it will certainly, I think, send a message to Congress that they need to be paying attention to this issue moving forward.
Going back to Congress, we want to talk about the 4th and the 5th Congressional District, a little bit of both going on. And those districts are in the upstate Midlands areas. But talking about the 4th Congressional District with Trey Gowdy, which covers Spartanburg and Greenville, that news also came out the same day as a train incident with the congressman. And Jamie, I know you were hustling all over the statehouse trying to get some comments, trying to get some ideas about who's going to pile into that race now that it's an open race. You know, you don't get to see these very often when these seats come up like this. Trey Gowdy's been up there for almost 10 years, more than 10
he
years?
Got in 2010. He won in the Tea Party wave of 2010, yeah. So about 8 years now.
So he's not going for his fifth term.
And, you know, look, this has been the most popular parlor game in Greenville politics for a very long time now. There are a lot of ambitious Republican politicians in Greenville that have been waiting for a chance to run for Congress. And within 2 hours of his announcement, we had already gotten three saying that they were going to run. Spartanburg GOP Chairman Josh Kimbrell is going to run. State Representative Dan Hamilton is going to run. And State Senator William Timmons is going to run. I think there are several more that are certainly considering it. And we may get more names in the time coming up. But look, you know, Trey Gowdy was always looking for an exit ramp from Congress from pretty much the day he got there. He was never a huge fan of the political game. He's much more a fan of the justice system. That's why he's going back to doing legal work. And, a lot of Greenville Republicans have been waiting for this day so they could get their shot. And now it's coming.
Yeah. And Gowdy came out with the statement, quote, "There's a time to come and go. And this is the right time for me to leave politics and return to the justice system." So like you're saying, something he's always been kind of alluding to. And there's always talk about him possibly going for a judgeship. But Senator Tim Scott kind of shot that down a little bit. But
apparently they tried to get him to do it and he didn't want to take it. Apparently Senator Graham and Senator Scott, from folks we've talked to, said, please take this opening judgeship. And he didn't want it. So right now he's going to start a private law firm is what we hear. And I'm sure he'll always be a contender anytime judicial vacancies open up from this point forward.
And just to wrap up here, I know we've been going long on the lead today, but I'm speaking with Jamie Lovegrove and Andy Brown from the Post and Courier. We're talking about a variety of topics. We're on Congress right now. And I want to talk to you, Jamie, again, just because you're so in tune with what's going on at the national level. Is that going to be the most interesting race to watch, or is this Archie Parnell, Ralph Norman race coming down a separate track and kind of catching anyone by surprise? I mean, was that shocking to see how much money Archie Parnell, a Democratic challenger, raised against Ralph Norman?
So I do think the 4th District is going to be the most interesting Republican primary to watch, certainly. The 5th District, I think, will be the most interesting general election to watch. The Democrat there, Archie Parnell, who just narrowly lost by 3% to Congressman Ralph Norman in a special election last year, a surprisingly close special election, really picked up right where he left off and has had a very, very successful start on fundraising for his campaign. He's got more than double the cash on hand right now, that the money in the bank, as Congressman Norman does. You know, Congressman Norman says that, look, I've been paying attention to my work in Congress. I have been fundraising. You know, we got plenty of time to do that. We do have a long time until November, let's be clear. But it is a troubling sign for him, I would think, you know, that – or it's at least a positive sign for Archie Parnell that he's going to be able to be competitive. It's still a very, very, very tough district for a Democrat to win. But if you have the resources, you can certainly at least make it a battle.
Really kind of something to watch. That's something we're going to be watching, especially on the campaign trail, our weekly segment that we're going to lead into. I know we kind of got on the campaign trail a little bit early with these new city slickers with us here, but we appreciate you guys making time for us. And we'll
see. I take offense to city slicker.
And we want to note that we wanted to give Andy Shane the week off this week because of the Eagles winning the Super Bowl, which I'm sure he's still recovering from. We're excited for him for that, and also some of our other folks here. South Carolina Public Radio are cheering the Eagles winning. So
mostly excited that the Patriots lost.
just a spin. Yeah. So thank you to Jamie Lovegrove and Andy Brown for joining us from the Post and Courier. Always a pleasure, and we look forward to see what's coming next.
Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin.
Well, it's just you and me now, partner, here on the Dusty Campaign Trail, where each week we recap state and local campaign news for you. This week, we look at a few more candidates who have hashtag hitched their wagons to the campaign trail as they head out to win voters around the state. Democrats saw a new contender jump in the gubernatorial race this week. Marguerite Willis, an antitrust attorney from Florence, saddled up and is the only female Democratic candidate so far in the field of three. She came out swinging in a debate last Friday night against two opponents, Columbia Representative James Smith and Charleston consultant Phil Noble. Now, Willis is a 67-year-old Democratic Party activist with no history of elected office, though her husband was mayor of Florence for 14 years. Switching to the Republican ticket, Governor Henry McMaster's press secretary tweeted a photo of the governor and First Lady Peggy McMaster standing proudly for the national anthem on Super Bowl Sunday, per a proclamation he issued earlier last week urging South Carolinians to do the same. The move was in light of NFL players who kneeled during the anthem in protest of police brutality. McMaster and others have scorned the protests, they say, disrespect the men and women who fought for our freedoms. Worth noting that those freedoms also include the First Amendment right to protest. And Attorney General Alan Wilson is kicking off his re-election campaign this week with stops across the state. Wilson first won office in 2010, but his connection to the embattled political consultant Richard Quinn and his company has drawn several challengers, including Representative Todd Atwater and Greenville attorney William Herlong. Welcome y'all to the trail. It's gonna get bumpy and dusty soon. We may even have to ford a river or two. So y'all hang on as we keep on this winding thing we all call the campaign trail. Now for Did You Know? In our final section, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. We name this section after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to one another on the House and Senate floors. Now, get ready for your mind to be blown. We're talking about the Statehouse dome here. And did you know that the exterior of the dome is covered with 44,000 pounds of copper? Let me repeat that. 44,000 pounds of copper clad the Statehouse dome in downtown Columbia. If that doesn't seem too impressive or freak you out, think about this. That's two-thirds of the copper that's in the Statue of Liberty, which is made of 62,000 pounds of copper. Now, to confuse you and freak you out even more, what you see on the outside is not what you see on the inside of the State House. On the inside dome you see from the lobby is a false dome. It's what they call false news, false dome, placed there for aesthetic purposes. The interior one is located directly beneath the exterior dome, but it's offset so it stays in the center of the lobby. So just something for you to think about while you look up in the State House lobby next time you're in there, thinking about those 8 million pennies worth of copper right above your head. Just a quick programming note. We won't have an episode for you next week because I'll be down in the Big Easy for Fat Tuesday, letting the good times roll. Don't worry, I haven't scheduled any news for next week. Just kidding. But we will have a piping hot episode for you on February 20th. Now, the South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed.
Watch my State House video recaps every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, live at 7 p.m. on SCETV's Facebook page, our YouTube page, and my Twitter account at Gavin Jackson. You can also read the State House Daybook on scetv.org and listen to coverage on South Carolina Public Radio. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app. And subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find podcasts. Email your questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. And the South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our coordinating producer. Our executive producers are Tom Posey and Russ McKinney. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on February 5th, 2018. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening, and go wash your hands, you dirty Eagles fans.